our previous programs and many other great programs as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Zionist Israeli entity intensified its aggression on Gaza while keeping one eye on Hezbollah in Lebanon and the other on the West Bank, primarily due to its strategic proximity. Neither the entity nor the United States of America foresaw that Yemen, which has been at war for years without a practical resolution, would turn into a new front. In November, the Yemeni armed forces declared war on the Zionist entity in support of the resistance in Gaza, presenting a significant and unwelcome surprise for the entity. Yemen initiated missile and drone attacks on targets in the Zionist Israeli port of Eilat, overlooking the Red Sea. However, the Yemeni armed forces did not stop there and announced the imposition of what could be described as a naval blockade on the entity. It appears that there are significant losses due to the Yemeni missiles, prompting the Pentagon in the first week of December to announce a plan to form a naval force to so-called protect international navigation in the Bab el-Mandeb Strait and the Red Sea. However, despite the availability of European countries' warships and frigates, they do not express great enthusiasm to join this force. Well, that is mainly due to the fact that European countries do not possess a large naval fleet. Warships are distributed between protecting the coasts of these countries and positioning near Ukraine in anticipation of any developments in the Russian-Ukrainian war. On the other hand, these countries are concerned that if they participate in confronting the Yemeni armed forces in their Gaza support operations, their commercial ships passing through the Bab el-Mandeb and the Red Sea could themselves become targets for the Yemenis. In the meantime, despite the Pentagon's threat to respond to the Yemenis, the Yemeni armed forces daily reaffirm their determination to continue targeting Israeli entity ships and ships bound towards occupied Palestine until the Zionist entity ends the genocide against Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. The matter is no longer limited to imposing a blockade on Zionist Israeli ports. The geostrategic battle and its escalating events are shaking the world. The closure of the Red Sea to ships colluding with the enemy turns into a heroic festival, teaching the U.S. and Zionist Israel harsh lessons and threatening them with more successive blows capable of breaking their alliances and coercive global policies. These strikes establish a new state of resistance given the expansion of its military operations and the development of its capabilities to combat malicious international hegemony. There is a clear evolution in the history of resistance post-October 7 and after the introduction of the equation of the Red Sea and the Bab el-Mandeb Strait. Welcome to the Middle East Stream. I'm Marwa Osman.
Christians and Christianity are under attack in Gaza and Palestine more generally. Zionist ideology is not just anti-Muslim, it is anti-Christian too. What is the common factor that links Muslims and Christians in Palestine? They're Palestinian. So it's no surprise that the Zionists are making sure to destroy churches as well as mosques. On October the 19th, Israel bombed the Church of St. Porphyrius, Gaza's oldest, killing at least 18 people. The church is said to be the third oldest Christian church in the world, with the current building having been constructed by the Crusaders in the 1150s or 1160s. A church was built on the site as early as 425 AD. 2 days earlier, an explosion at Al-Ahli Arab Hospital, an Anglican institution located a few blocks away, killed and injured hundreds, according to Palestinian health authorities. The evidence is beginning to mount that the attacks on specifically Christian targets are themselves a specific genocide contained within the larger genocide aimed at Muslims and indeed all Palestinians. On December 16th, the Zionists directly targeted a Christian convent. An Israeli army sniper assassinated two Christian women, Nahed and her daughter Samar, inside the parish of the Holy Family in Gaza on Saturday, said the Latin Patriarchate's media office. One of the women fell while trying to rescue the other. Seven others were injured while attempting to help. Gunfire was directed at them inside the walls of the monastery, and there was no resistance in the area, it added. An Israeli artillery vehicle also targeted the Monastery of the Sisters of Mother Teresa in Gaza City, which shelters more than 54 disabled individuals within the church walls. The Zionist attack also destroyed the fuel tank, the power generator, and the solar panels, in addition to extensive damage that rendered the place unsuitable for habitation or providing care for people with disabilities. On January the 26th this year, a mob of Israeli settlers attacked an Armenian bar in the Christian quarter of the Old City of Jerusalem, shouting, "Death to Arabs, death to Christians." At the beginning of October, a video emerged of ultra-Orthodox settlers in Al-Quds spitting on Christian pilgrims. Armed and violent settlers are also in the process of attempting to liquidate the Armenian quarter in Al-Quds, and with it, the wider Christian presence, which has been there continuously since the 4th century. Only 800 to 1,000 Christians are believed to still live in Gaza, constituting the oldest Christian community in the world, dating back to the 1st century.
This year, Christmas celebrations are cancelled in Bethlehem, and for obvious reasons. It's impossible to celebrate while our people in Gaza are going through a genocide.
It's no wonder the church in Palestine has cancelled Christmas.
Hunger has become the most pressing of the myriad problems facing hundreds of thousands of displaced Gaza Palestinians, with aid trucks able to bring in only a small fraction of what is needed, and distribution uneven due to the chaos of the war. The Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, a Geneva-based rights group, has found that 71% of people in the Gaza Strip suffer from extreme hunger due to Israel's devastating war on the Palestinian territory and the regime's method of using starvation as a weapon. The group released the figure after it conducted an analytical study of a sample of 1,200 people in Gaza. According to the study's findings, 98% of respondents said that they eat insufficient amounts of food, while 64% of the participants admitted to eating grass, immature food, and expired materials to satiate their hunger.
All 2.2 million people are hungry, meaning that they are in crisis or worse food security situation.
More than 130,000 of Gaza's most vulnerable children, that is newborns up to 2 years of age, are not receiving the critical life-saving breastfeeding or age-appropriate complementary feeding that they absolutely require. So that's our scenario. Without sufficient safe water, food and sanitation that only a humanitarian ceasefire would bring, child deaths due to disease could well surpass those already killed in bombardments.
The study found that the rate of access to water in the Gaza Strip, including drinking, bathing, and cleaning water, is 1.5 liters per person per day. This is 15 liters less than the minimum amount of water required for survival at the level required by international standards. Additionally, the study examined the effects of malnutrition and a lack of access to clean drinking water. 66% of the study sample reported having experienced diarrhea, skin rashes, or intestinal diseases in the past month. Even in Rafah, which has a crossing to Egypt through which aid trucks enter, the dearth of food and clean water is so severe, it is causing people to get ill.
The contaminated water is another issue, as the water is not 100% clean. So children and adults suffer from intestinal problems such as vomiting and diarrhea. So I ran out of antidiarrheal medications, Flagyl medicines, which is an intestinal disinfectant, and Silabrin, which is antibiotics for intestinal infections. There's a significant loss of these drugs.
Since the start of its genocide in Gaza, Israel has imposed a comprehensive blockade on the Strip and prevented supplies of food, water, fuel, and other humanitarian necessities from reaching the more than 2.3 million residents of the Strip. Israel's use of starvation as a weapon has intensified since October 7, and has included cutting off all food supplies to Gazans, as well as bombing and destroying the Strip's bakeries, factories, food stores.
We were compelled to come here as there are no bakeries available. The people here who are our friends are baking bread to aid the community. Procuring flour is challenging for us, as a 20-kilogram bag costs around 300 to 400 shekels, which is a substantial amount.
About 577,000, meaning more than 500,000 people, are already in catastrophic levels of hunger, meaning they're essentially starving. That is like one in every four people.
Speeches and statements from Israeli officials promoting a campaign to deliberately block access to necessary resources for the Gaza population as a strategy indicate that Israel has not made these intentions a secret. The Israeli blockade, on top of the genocidal aggression, has plunged Gaza into humanitarian catastrophe, where lack of access to sanitation and safe water has increased the prevalence of waterborne diseases. The Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court says that intentionally starving civilians by, quote, depriving them of objects indispensable to their survival, including willfully impeding relief supplies, is a war crime.
The people in the hospitals, yes, they need everything. They need medical supplies, but what they ask for first is food and water, the very basics. They do not have them. One of my colleagues described people lying on the floor in severe pain, in agony, but they weren't asking for pain relief. They were asking for water.
The plight of Gaza's 2.3 million people has become desperate amid the war. Around 80% of Palestinians living in the Gaza Strip have been displaced by the violence, while efforts to get aid into the territory have struggled. Alarmed humanitarian organizations have been calling for a ceasefire and denouncing the shocking cost of the catastrophic war, which amounts to a collective punishment of the civilian population of Gaza.
We are homeless. We can't go back to our houses. I want to see my children. I want to go back to my husband and to my house. It's unfair. It's so unfair.
This is a firm response to Israel's genocide and aggression against Palestinians. It has been about 2.5 months since Israel launched its deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank. Muslim countries missed no chance to deplore the Israeli crimes verbally, but there were few, including Yemen, that firmly stood in solidarity with defenseless Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. After carrying out drone and missile strikes on Israeli targets, Yemen's armed forces have now been targeting Israel-bound vessels in waters around their country. The army has time and again stated it would stop its operations if Israel stops its aggression and ends its blockade on Gaza. The Yemeni armed forces have also refuted claims about targeting ships moving toward other destinations. All vessels except Israel-bound ones can safely sail through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. As usual, Israel's main backer, the U.S., has been trying to reverse the impact of the Yemeni operations by announcing the formation of a maritime coalition under the pretext that it would protect the transit in the Red Sea. But Washington's main goal is to protect Israel's interest. However, Yemen's Ansarullah has issued strong warning to the U.S. Mohammed al-Bukhaiti, a senior Ansarullah official, says the newly formed coalition will get a painful response if it violates the sovereignty of the Arab country. But how significant the Yemeni operations in the Red Sea are? In recent weeks, Yemeni naval forces have targeted several vessels sailing through the Red Sea toward Israel. Their primary goal has been to exert economic pressure on Tel Aviv, and they have been rather successful. Several major companies have suspended their shipments to and from Israel in the wake of Yemen's operations in the Red Sea. This has dealt a heavy blow to Israel's economy, with the latest reports indicating that the port of Eilat is hardly hit as the result of this disruption.
The non-arrival of ships to Eilat means that there is no income for the port, while the fixed expenses for its maintenance and operation remain the same, and we have a substantial negative flow.
The almost complete halt to the arrival of ships to Eilat has led to an 80% fall in the port's profits. This is while reports say that Egypt's Suez Canal has seen no harm to its maritime activities during Yemen's operations against Israel-bound ships. The Red Sea is a strategic trade route connecting Asia to Europe through the Suez Canal. About 12% of global trade passes through the Red Sea, including 30% of global container traffic. The disruptions in this area have had a direct impact on global economy. Now, cargo ships traveling from Asia to Europe have to sail around the African continent. This has increased the transit time and led to higher freight rates and delays. Also, shipping insurance costs have jumped by tens of thousands of dollars a day, and oil prices have gone up as well. To sum up, the international community has been unable to stop the Israeli crimes against Palestinians through political means. However, it seems Yemenis have employed a successful tactic to pressurize Israel.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, in which we try to ask and answer some of the questions related to the Islamic laws based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before we embark on our episode, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, we testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, That's the first year that he started his Bahth al-Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching maqasid, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up till 1347, he was actively participating in Bahth al-Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahth al-Kharij, he started Bahth al-Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, my guest speaker as always. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh, and welcome to the program.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. We are still working on some of the jurisprudential laws about khums based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. Sheikh Javid, is khums applicable to that kind of money which is saved from monthly salary to purchase some stuff, you know, for the wedding, for example, in the future?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, again, I should say that this is a matter of, you know, controversy among the Shia scholars. Some believe that khums should be paid on anything over which 1 year runs. And some other scholars of the view that no, as long as it's an essential thing and as long as you cannot buy it in the future and you want to buy it now to be prepared for the wedding,
mm-hmm.
so you don't have to pay khums on it. Now, this is the viewpoint of His Eminence Grand Ayatollah Khamenei. He says that, for example, if you save the money you receive as your monthly, for example, salary,
mm-hmm.
Of course, and in the event that you want to use the money to buy necessary items for your wedding within several days, for example,
yes.
You don't have to pay khums. For example, today is your khums date, and you're supposed to calculate all the asset and money that you have saved up.
Yes.
But maybe after a week or maybe after 10 days, you are going to buy something for your wedding. So you will not be able to buy it if you spend your money or if you pay khums on the money.
Mm-hmm.
So within several days, you are going to buy it. According to Ayatollah Khamenei, it's not necessary to pay khums on the money, which is saved for that very purpose.
Mm-hmm. I see.
Yes.
Only for the wedding, you mean? Like, what about the necessities of life? Does it also apply to that kind of money saved?
Of course, in the answer given by His Eminence, he has just mentioned the term, he has used the term wedding, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, when it
I understand if it is saved, if the money is saved for luxurious life, like items.
Yeah.
Like if you're going to, for example, live a life of luxury, that's a different story.
That's a different story, yeah.
But what about the necessities of
For example,
life?
You want to buy a washing machine, which
uh-huh.
you need. Or
yes.
You can't wash your
You can't
clothes.
Ignore this.
You need a refrigerator
mm-hmm.
and also some, let's say, rugs or carpets.
Yes.
You can't live in your house without a carpet. So
yes.
these are essential items, okay? And no one is going to blame you for buying these things, okay?
Yes.
These are not something in addition, luxurious.
Yes.
Every individual must have or needs to have something like a carpet or rug or refrigerator. to live a comfortable life, mm-hmm. not a luxurious life. So he does not have to pay khums on the money that goes towards buying these things.
Mm-hmm, I see. Okay. There's another question, Sheikh Javid. We all know that it's mentioned in the book Tahrir al-Masir, written by Ayatollah Imam Khomeini, that a woman's dowry is not subject to khums.
Yeah.
But, you know, the question is, it didn't specify whether it's for the dowry that is paid at the time of the marriage or deferred.
You're right.
Would you please explain this?
Well, we do know that that the dowry or mahar, which is fixed by both parties to the marriage, is either paid immediately by the husband, or it is a kind of deferred payment, which is paid by the husband at a, you know, at any time upon demand. Okay, the wife demands and wants the dowry to be paid, the husband will have to pay it because it's a debt, which the husband has to pay it. If he does not pay it, he will be liable for it. Now, it doesn't make any difference whether the pay is, for example, is due, whether it is the money has to be paid immediately or it's paid at a later time. In either case, according to all religious scholars, there is no khums paid on dowry. No khums is payable on mahr. This is a matter of consensus.
I see. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program, Islamic Laws, on RIB English Radio. Stay with us.
The followers of Ayatollah Khomeini can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khomeini's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah, ya Allah, oh Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and just with our guest speaker, we're still talking about some of the jurisprudential laws related to homes based on the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khomeini. Sheikh Javid, if an individual at the time that he was alive, he recorded or she recorded in their diary the amount of homes they owed.
Yes.
And, of course, those individuals, they were determined to pay it, but they died, all right?
Yes.
After their death, their family, their entire family, with the exception of one, for example, daughter,
yes,
refused to pay the juhums. And they're using the estate for their own use and the deceased expenses, as well as other things. Would you please tell our audience about Ayatollah Khomeini's opinion regarding this matter?
And this is a very good issue. If the deceased person has provided in his will that a part of his property is to be paid for khums, or actually the heirs are certain that the deceased owed an amount of khums, it is necessary that they act accordingly. Of course, they are not permitted under any circumstances to use the estate before they carry out the deceased's or the deceased person's will. So they should pay the khums that deceased person owed. And of course, it's necessary that they seriously determine to settle the khums debt and execute the will without carelessness. You know, it is very urgent and also very important that the heirs should act according to the will left by the by the man of the family or by the individual. So if he has any debt to be paid, it should be paid off. If he has homes amount on his on to be paid during his lifetime, but he failed to do so because he was ill, he couldn't make time to do it, it's necessary that the heirs should take immediate action to relieve him of this obligation to pay the homes.
Yes.
You see, they cannot, for example, the heirs cannot refuse. To abide or to confiscate the property and avoid paying homes.
I see. Okay. There's another question let me ask at the end of this episode. Is it obligatory for employees having a surplus of money remaining over their annual expenses to pay homes in light of the fact that they still owe some money which is due, or should be paid in installments?
Well, if the debt incurred during the year due to borrowing money for expenditure of the same year or due to purchase of some necessities for the same year on credit, it is subtracted from the remaining income at the end of the year. Because as long as you, for example, buy something on credit, and then the salary is used to pay off the debt in the same year, not the previous year, because that we have to differentiate between the loan received in this year or the money borrowed in this year or the money borrowed in the previous year. If you pay off your debt which you owed even last year or the year before last with the salary you received in this year, of course you have to pay homes from the salary. But if you buy something on credit or if you borrow money in the same year in which you are earning money, now you don't have to pay homes because you need to pay installments. You need to pay off the debt first.
Yes.
And then if there's anything left, you will have to pay homes. Otherwise, you are not liable for homes.
Thank you very much, Shastri. And thank you for joining us for the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. We bid you farewell. Keep us in your du'as. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Welcome back to a new episode of your very favorite Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma, your host. Once again, I have the honor to be here at your service. And then here with us, we have two very dear guests, Sister Bita and Brother Hassanain. So as the ritual of this program goes, I would like you both to introduce yourself very much briefly. Let's just start with Sister Bita.
Wa alaikum assalam, my dear sister and my dear brother here at Back to Reality. I am Bita and I have the pleasure to be here again. And I'm studying medicine at one of the universities in Tehran. And that's it.
Thank you and wish you luck. And you, brother?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Thank you for having us. Hope everyone's doing well. I'm a student in the Islamic Seminary of Qom, and I'm doing my bachelor's.
So thank you, both of you, for being here. It's always a pleasure to sit here and have a discussion with you guys. There are many stories in literature and many real stories that we can see in everyday life. There are many people who have a certain sort of religion, and then they do a lot of prayings, they do a lot of their responsibilities and their duties, but unfortunately, you do not see the effect of it, the reflection of those moral beliefs and concepts in their everyday action. Like, you know, they go for prostration, they do pray, they do devote a special time for their moral religious activities, but then at the same time, they are, I don't want to put it this way because that seems so harsh. We don't have a lot of these people. Let's say that these people are just living on other planets, but then they are not in good manners.
Yeah. You know, all of these stories remind me of the story that we have in our literature. The man that actually worshipped Allah Almighty for 70 years. And after 70 years, only one night he had fun. I didn't have drinking alcohol or something. And actually, all those years were burnt because, you know, worshipping without an insight, worshipping without the knowledge of what you're saying is, you know, is I don't say it's completely meaningless, but when it doesn't
it's
make
habit
you,
formation, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
When it becomes your habit, but it does not change you.
There is this story from Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, that actually he passed of one of his companions that was worshipping all day long. And Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, told him, you have to work, okay? You know, religion doesn't mean that you have to worship all day. You have to put a specific time for worshiping, yeah, a specific time for work.
You have to contribute to your society,
exactly,
and the people around you. It's,
yeah,
not just worshiping as an act, because,
yeah,
you know, helping other people is also a way of praying.
Exactly.
What do you say, brother?
I would like to say that, like, first of all, let's get this clear first. Like, you know, like worshiping or salat, it is, you know, first of all, to be clear, it's from the obligations of Islam. So it's a religious duty upon us. But it is not the criterion to identify someone as a good person.
Mm-hmm.
There are many people that they pray regularly, like five times a day. But they're still, you know, they might not be good in their personality or their characteristics.
So what is the reason behind that?
Like, first of all, let me give an example. Like, you know, like example on the day of Ashura. Like, what was the time when Imam Hussein alayhi salam was martyred?
Mm-hmm.
It was near the Asr time. So there were people in the army of Yazid. They were saying, like, just do not delay in beheading Imam Hussein alayhi salam, or else we'll get late to the prayers. They were Quran reciters. There were people who used to pray salat,
mm-hmm,
in the army of Yazid who have come to kill Imam Hussein. So from this, we understand that this is not the criteria. So what is the reason now? So look, first of all, prayer is for us to make us humble. And if it is not making us humble, then we're not doing the right prayer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we're just doing it as
an obligatory sort of action.
Just as a norm. Like, you know, it just become a habit for us.
Yeah.
Even still, like, someone might question, like, okay, even he's not doing it for the purpose which is supposed to be due, praying for so many years, why isn't it taking him closer to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala? Or why isn't it making him a better person?
Yeah, so keep the answer for after the break. Thank you very much. So back to reality it is. Yeah, brother, you were talking about why, yeah, isn't it making him a better person?
Satan is known to be like from the great worshippers. Only his prostrations were like for thousands of years.
Yeah.
But still, what's the end? So why doesn't it make people a good person? Like, so now, as we mentioned, like prayers to make us humble. For example, I tell you, let me give an example so that we can understand this in a better way. For example, if I tell you that, you know, to gain more physical strength, to gain more energy, you need to consume protein. Mm-hmm. You need to consume more protein. For example, like chickens got more protein. It's like rich in protein. So if you leave everything and for days and days, if you just keep eating chicken.
Without practicing, without going to gym.
No, that's not efficient over here. I'm trying to say something else. If you just keep eating chicken, what will happen? You will gain protein, but you will lack in the other required things. Like, you know, your body requires, you know, certain amounts of fats.
Mm-hmm.
Your body requires certain amount of carbohydrates.
Yeah.
So it'll make you worse.
In this sense, you actually mean it's not worshipping alone that counts. We have to put it into practice.
I'm saying that, you know, it's not the worship itself. It's like, okay, first we need to know why are we worshipping?
Yeah.
Who are we worshipping? Worshipping is not the only thing that's obligatory on us.
Mm-hmm.
There are many different things as well.
Yeah. So, Sister Rita, according to you, why that does not affect me?
First of all, I have to tell that intention is greater than the thing that you're doing.
Yeah.
Okay, so your intention is really
important.
Which
we have it in our narrations.
Yeah. And another thing is that you have to put all the things you do in a functional way. The thing that, I'm in a medical school and they're trying to teach us to be functional. It means that it doesn't matter how many books, how many references, how many articles you read, you have to put that in a practical situation.
That's very important,
okay?
Yeah.
And
it must be practical.
It is exactly the same.
Preaching is not enough.
Yeah, it really
saying
content.
Something is not enough. Doing it in the best way possible,
yeah,
might do some changes.
Yeah, exactly. You know what? I always thought, like, for example, these people doesn't have the knowledge or they cannot understand the meaning of the verses that they are actually reciting or something like that. But sometimes even they know the knowledge, they have the knowledge of what is true and what is not, but they don't practice it. Okay,
mm-hmm.
You have to practice religion. The way we look at religion is not something from, I don't know, heaven, something really far-fetched. No, it's a lifestyle. Okay, you have to put that in every little single part of your life. And in our religion, Islam is really complete. We have a clue, we have a sentence, we have a narration, a story, something to learn for every part of your life.
Yeah. And we have a social aspect,
yeah,
in our religion. So people are not merely individuals who are living alienated from other people in society.
Yeah, the individualism. That's,
yeah, that's
these
not
days.
That way. We have to care for other people. So if you're worshiping and if you think that worship is going to benefit you too much, or if you're doing that in the expectations of too much of rewards in the other world, then you can do it in some other ways. Like, for example, you help your neighbors. Like, for example, you help your family.
And
there
actually,
are people,
yeah,
who know that their family members are suffering, but they do not go for lending any helping hand.
And actually, my brother mentioned really something really interesting. It was the example about protein and carbohydrate or something like that. We call it the caricature effect. I mean, you nourish one specific part of your life and you leave all the other parts alone. Okay? It's not going to work.
Yeah,
you have to keep the balance in every part of your life.
Exactly. Yeah. Before we get into what brother is going to say, let's just go for a short break for a change of mood and then we'll be back. Thank you for staying with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. Well, this is the last part of today's episode. Thank you for staying with us. I hope you're just enjoying. Whatever we say in here are just going to count as clues for you to ponder more and to think more and more, more deeply into whatever that happens in our everyday life. So, brother, you were about to say something.
Yeah, since we're talking about prayer, like we're saying that, you know, we shouldn't conclude this in a wrong way.
Yeah.
You know, someone might conclude as, okay, so, you know, he's praying and still he's not a good person. So it means that, you know, prayer is not beneficial for us.
Exactly. So this is a wrong conclusion. And all the religious people are bad people.
Yeah. So this is not the right conclusion. And so what is the right thing then? So as Sister also mentioned, you know, when we're doing something, when we're worshiping or we're praying, so intention is a key role of this thing. So what are our intentions? It also matters. You know, prayer, when you look at the prayer, you know, there's prayer, Allah has set an obligation on the salat. So it makes us, as I mentioned, it makes us more humble and, you know, it brings humility in us. You know, you see, there's so many times bowing in the prayer. So, you know, when you bow in front of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, it makes you humble. So if it's not making you humble, then you're not doing the right prayer. So why does this happen? This happens because many a times it happens due to the lack of knowledge. You know, if it's not making you humble, if it's not making you a better person, so it means that you're not doing it the right way. You're just doing it as a, you know, just
obligation, because of being a habit.
Not even obligation, just because you got used to it. It's just your habit because your father told you, you have listened from someone, you know, it's obligatory on you. You have to pray this every day.
Because so, I fear hell, for example.
Yeah. So you did not understand the true meaning mm-hmm. of worship.
Yeah.
Like, for instance, there's a hadith, there's a narration from Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam regarding worship that, O Allah, I do not worship you from the fear of hell. O Allah, I do not worship you from the fear of hell, neither do I worship you in the
hope of heaven.
In the hope of heaven. Rather, I worship you because you're worth of being worshipped.
Yeah.
So to, you know, get rid of this thing, you know, lack of knowledge and, you know, not benefiting the most from our prayers.
We need to understand the meaning of prayer.
Mm-hmm. We need to understand who we are worshipping. So that brings pleasure in our worship.
Yeah, what I always think of our praying and the worship style that we have, I always come up with this point that we even have it in our literature. Unless you feel in love truly and deeply with your Lord, you're not going to enjoy your worship, and your worship is not going to be reflected in the actions you're going to do and in the behaviors you're going to share with other people.
Exactly. And you know, I have this belief that a tinge of doubt in everything will strengthen your belief.
Yeah.
You know, you have to question everything. You have to question your, you know, praying. You are praying every day as a habit of your, I don't know, childhood. Then you are an adult. You have to ask, why am I doing this?
Yeah, okay? Why am I doing this?
And this question is a trigger for you to go for the answer, to understand the depth
and
of
it
relationship.
It depends, actually. It strengthens your love.
Exactly.
And even the morals that you keep inside yourself.
And the bond that you have with Allah Almighty.
Which is so important.
That is the gist of our
story. You mentioned a really good point that, you know, we can pray a good prayer when we get to know a lot, like when we love a lot. So, but first we need to look like, how can we get in love with Allah? How can we get in love with our Creator?
Mm-hmm.
So the purpose of, you know, if you look in the Holy Quran, even the purpose of creation is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, وَمَا خَلَقْتُ الْجِنَّ وَالْإِنْسِ إِلَّا لِيَعْبُدُونَ. So I haven't created humans or the jinns except so that they worship me.
Mm-hmm.
So but in the riwayat, in the tafasir, we get from the narrations of the holy imams that over here, ya'budun means ya'rifun.
To know him.
To know him.
Find him worthy of that worship.
Ahsan, yeah,
the thing that you
when
cannot
you get to know
just
him.
So thank you. Thank you, sister, and thank you, brother. Yeah, and thank you, dear listeners, for staying with us. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. Until another session, I bid you farewell. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah. يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي
let the ummah rise again.
Ya Allah,
Ya Rabb al-alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi, let the ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
In the limelight. When it comes to nominating contests, more than half of U.S. Democrats and Republicans said they were not confident their party would choose a candidate who could win the 2024 presidential election. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. Associated Press has covered this story and tells us more. According to a new survey, a possible rematch between President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump is not exciting the American public. The Associated Press NORC Research Center poll published recently found that 56% of U.S. adults overall, regardless of party affiliation, would be very or somewhat dissatisfied with Biden as a Democratic presidential nominee. On the other side, about 58% said the same thing about Donald Trump being the potential GOP nominee. About 3 in 10 U.S. adults, or 28%, said they would be dissatisfied with both Donald Trump and Joe Biden becoming the nominee, with independents, 43%, more likely than Democrats, 28%, or Republicans, 20%, to express displeasure with both politicians clinching to their party nominations. However, pollsters found more Republicans are more satisfied with Donald Trump leading the ticket than Democrats are satisfied with Joe Biden leading their ticket. Almost half, or 49% of Democrats, said they would be very or somewhat satisfied with the incumbent as their party's nominee, while 65% of Republicans said the same thing about the former president, Donald Trump. When it comes to the nominating contest, less than half of Democrats and Republicans said they were confident their party would choose a candidate who could win the general election in November. The poll found about 29% of Democrats said they are very or extremely confident their party will choose a winning nominee, while 33% of Republicans said the same. Negativity around the 2024 election doesn't appear to be limited to the presidential candidates either. Roughly 68% of those surveyed said they are pessimistic about the state of politics in the United States as a whole. Republicans are more pessimistic than Democrats that their party's primary votes will be accurately counted, with about 37% saying they have a great deal of confidence. A majority of Democrats, 72%, said the same thing about their party. Opinion polls' findings come as Donald Trump and Joe Biden appear to be on their way to clinching their party's nominations, just weeks before the primary season kicks off with the Iowa caucus. Donald Trump has maintained a strong lead in the polls since announcing his re-election bid, despite facing four criminal inducements and a civil fraud trial in New York. While Democrats don't appear enthused about Joe Biden as their prospective nominee, his primary challengers have struggled to gain significant momentum. According to a new survey, Donald Trump is leading President Biden in seven swing states, dealing the latest blow to Biden's re-election campaign just weeks ahead of the start of the primary voting season. The opinion poll published recently from Morning Consult and Bloomberg News Agency found Joe Biden is trailing the former President Donald Trump by an average of 5.28 percentage points, in the 7 swing states surveyed. The states of North Carolina, Georgia, Wisconsin, Nevada, Michigan, Arizona, and Pennsylvania. Donald Trump held his strongest lead over Joe Biden in North Carolina with 11 percentage points, followed by Georgia, 7%. The former president is leading in Wisconsin by 6% and in Nevada by 5%, according to the pollsters. His smallest leads are in Michigan and Arizona, leading by 4% and 3% respectively. The results are from a hypothetical ballot that includes party frontrunners, Biden and Trump, as well as third-party candidates like Robert Kennedy Jr., Corwell West, and Jill Stein. There was also an option for participants to choose an unlisted candidate or answer "don't know, no opinion," or choose to forgo voting altogether. Robert F. Kennedy Jr. had support from roughly 1 in 10 voters across the swing states, while 1% to 2% of voters in each state supported Colonel West. 1% to 3% of voters supported Jill Stein, and 1% to 3% supported a candidate not on the ballot. Pollsters said when the third-party candidates are taken off the ballot, Donald Trump continues to lead Joe Biden in all 7 swing states, though Georgia's race comes within a margin of error of 6 percentage points. The survey also found that Donald Trump secured more support from respondents when looking at the economy. However, when it comes to the issue of health care, Joe Biden has a slight lead over the former president in 5 of the swing states, namely Arizona, Michigan, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin. According to the survey, Donald Trump still leads on the issue in Georgia and North Carolina. British newspaper The Daily Mail has also covered the same story and tells us more. Former President Donald Trump is extending his lead over U.S. President Joe Biden as the contours of next year's presidential election come into focus. Trump may face legal jeopardy as he battles a string of court cases, but he now leads Joe Biden by 4 percentage points in the latest Daily Mail J.L. Partners opinion poll. The results show the former president winning over independent voters, while Joe Biden has seen his support fall within his own party and among women. The numbers will reignite debate about whether or not Biden, 81 years old, can generate enough excitement around Democrats to make good on his promise that he is the best candidate to beat Donald Trump, 77 years old. And it comes after a separate Daily Mail opinion poll showed he was losing to Donald Trump in 2 out of 3 key battleground states. To look at the overall national picture, JL Partners surveyed 984 likely voters using landline and cell phone calls, as well as SMS messages and smartphone apps. When asked who they would vote for if the election were tomorrow, 40% of respondents picked Donald Trump, and 36% of respondents chose Joe Biden. Independents Robert Kennedy Jr. and Cornel West won 4% and 1% respectively, while Green candidate Jill Stein's share was around 0%. That leaves a lot to play for. Some 18% said they were still undecided or wanted a different candidate. And the poll went into the field before Colorado's Supreme Court added another twist, disqualifying the former President Donald Trump from the state's Republican primary. Even so, James Johnson, the co-founder of JL Partners, claimed that Donald Trump was on the up and up. He said, "Voters might think that Trump is guilty of the charges that have been put to him, including a sizable chunk of Republicans, but his record in his first term in office means he's still attracting support." James Johnson added, "But look closer and it becomes clear that Donald Trump's lead is more because of Biden's weakness than Trump's strength. Biden has taken a particular hit among 18 to 29-year-old women and suffers from low enthusiasm among black people, too. There is also a big chunk of undecideds, 1 in 10 of Biden's 2020 voters who might not like Biden but can't bring themselves to vote for Donald Trump." Biden has struggled with questions about his age, and voters continue to say that they are worried about the economy under his stewardship. In contrast, Donald Trump seems not to have suffered from indictments in four criminal cases during the past year. Whether a conviction would finally strip away his non-stick coating remains to be seen.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house.